The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters.
This week, we're going to take a little bit of a break from the world of the daily news, which is remains very grim, and talk about something, I think, a little bit more pleasant. Movies, and in particular, movies about lesbians. In the last few weeks, Hollywood has released two movies that both feature lesbian as lead characters, and both are kind of genre mashups, taking very traditional forms. In the one hand, the buddy road trip movie, and on the other hand, the erotic thriller, and give a sort of sapphic spin on these time-honored plots. Both movies are set in the late 20th century. I'm talking, of course, about Drive Away Dolls, directed by Ethan Coen and written by Coen and his partner, Trisha Cook, and also Love Lies Bleeding, directed by Rose Glass. So to talk about these two movies, and we're very welcome to have a frequent guest of the program, Maura Donegan, who I think can bring some insights into what's going on in these movies and the sort of cultural shifts that they represent. So welcome to the program.
Hi, Jeet. Thanks for having me.
So in terms of the two movies, both movies are filled with the kind of period era paraphernalia of not just the general culture, but particularly the kind of like lesbian culture. Both movies have lesbian bars. I think Drive Away Dolls more so. I think that's actually a very important thematic element of that movie. And so maybe that is a good sort of place to start, because I think that there is a kind of nostalgia for the late 20th century lesbian bar. And maybe we can talk about that to begin with.
Yeah, you know, Drive Away Dolls, the Ethan Coen movie, is this fun, light, silly kind of road trip sex comedy that features two women in the very like classic comedic pairing of an uptight straight man and a loose, goofy companion who are on a road trip and have various cases of mistaken identity and get into some, you know, humorous scrapes. And part of this movie, or a feature of the plot, is that as they are driving through the country, they stop at a number of lesbian bars. This plot, which is, as you mentioned, is set in 1999, but it comes at a moment of, you know, in 2024, some anxiety and nostalgia for the lesbian bar as an institution, right? So America has seen a pretty precipitous decline in the number of lesbian bars, particularly over the past, you know, like 15 years. And in, you know, in New York, there was three for a long time. There were Ginger's in Brooklyn. I'm sorry, there were four. There was Ginger's in Brooklyn. There was the Boom Boom Room in Queens. And then there was the Cubby Hole and Henrietta Hudson, which are a block away from each other. In the West Village, and then the Boom Boom Room closed. Where I live in San Francisco, I'm a couple of blocks away from like this monument, really like a quasi shrine in the Mission, to the Lexington Club, which was a long time, very much beloved lesbian bar that closed in the 2010s, I think like 2016 it shut down. And this is sort of the 2010s and after story of the lesbian bar, right? It's beloved. It is an institution. It is central to the queer and lesbian life of a city, but it cannot manage to remain viable as a business and therefore has to close, right? So that the disappearing lesbian bar has been the subject of a lot of you know, anxiety, nostalgia, and grief among queer women's communities. And there's a couple of different like theories about the disappearance mm-hmm. of the lesbian bar. One theory is that, you know, gay life in general no longer requires these special spaces, right? Because increase in acceptance of gay people, or at least what looked like the sort of historically permanent increase in the acceptance of gay people in the 2000s and 2010s, made it so that you did not need a designated space to go to flirt or to be you know, comfortably out and frank about your sexuality. You did not need a designated space in which to be you know, comfortably in public with your partner. These are now things that gay people increasingly have the ability to do in general public or like quote unquote straight spaces, right? So that's one theory of the decline of the lesbian bar. It's like they don't need the bars anymore because you can be a lesbian at any bar or almost any bar. That is one theory that does not quite account for the asymmetry in like the bar scene, right? Because gay bars that cater to men are really doing like fine. They're doing quite well. there's a lot of them. They're out here. In fact, a lot of queer women's like nightlife has shifted to these like once monthly or once weekly parties at men's bars. You know, mm-hmm. it's usually like a Wednesday or something. and there will be, you know, a woman DJ, and this is like the women's night. So like those bars are doing quite well, which suggests that there's something different about the lesbian bar in particular than about the gay bar, right? And there are a couple of theories about lesbian bars in particular. One is that a little bit of a, you know, perhaps a tad gender essentialist account of the lesbian U-Haul problem, right? Which is this theory in which lesbians and queer women don't spend as much time in nightlife, right? They're not as interested in the sort of drinking, partying, casual sex that the bar scene enables, that they have this tendency to pair off in monogamous couples with like eagerness and speed. And that those are people who spend a lot of time, you know, nesting and cuddling at home and not a lot of time buying rounds and, you know, financing these bars. So that's sort of like the U-Haul theory of the decline of the gay bar, right? Is that like lesbians don't have as much use for nightlife as men do. You know, that might be, maybe, who knows?
Although, again, that doesn't quite explain the historical, well, like why it's happening now rather than in the, you know, 80s and 90s.
But, right, like if this is a trans-historical fixed quality of lesbians, that it should have been such in the 1980s and 90s when these bars were doing much better, right? So that's another theory that I also think is kind of incomplete. One that I buy into a little bit more is the bit about gentrification. You know, these cities where it is safest, most gratifying, and most fruitful to be both, you know, heterosexually unattached woman and an out gay person at the same time, tend to be coastal cities, right? Like my friends and I talk about paying a gay tax because you really can't live, or at least you can't live with as good satisfaction as a lesbian in the cheapest parts of this country, right? You'll be subject to public hostility, potential discrimination, and just very, very few options for your social life. You want to live where it is easiest to be a lesbian, and you want to live where all the lesbians are, which is primarily New York and California, these very expensive places to live. So there's, you know, this kind of contradiction where the lesbians are concentrated in these places where they can't necessarily afford to be, right? And there's... a couple of things that make lesbians distinct from gay men in this regard. And one of them is just that we don't make as much money. Lesbians do earn more, or tend to have higher incomes rather than straight women do. I think this is largely a function of the fact that we don't give birth quite as often. But they make significantly less money than gay men do. And that is, you know, something you see across the board. And it is also something that makes it harder for them to live in these urban centers, right? A lot of people are getting displaced out into, you know, perhaps less expensive suburbs. And then what are you going to do? Are you going to drive across the Bay Bridge? Are you going to take the Metro North into Brooklyn to get your you know, happy hour bar? No, you're not going to be schlepping that far to go to a bar. So there's a sort of gentrification problem along with a perhaps like less of a demand for nightlife. I think there's also, you also have to take into account the fact that there are just fewer lesbians than there are gay men. They are just numerically greater than we are, which means that necessarily, in addition to their higher incomes, they necessarily have more spending power. But then you also have this like persistent gentrification problem. And this is all, you know, before you get into what might be the real big generational difference, which is that a lot of gay life has shifted into places that can be like sort of divested of straight homophobia, that can be maintained as affordable, and that can travel with lesbians to the places that they wind up being able to afford to live. And that's the internet. The internet has really replaced a lot of these spaces than what were brick and mortar physical bars where you could go drink some terrible beer and, you know, make eyes at somebody in a leather vest, have now become digital spaces that serve a lot of those same functions.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad we had the, you set up the sort of, you know, material changes in the life of lesbians, you know, over the last two or three decades, because I think that actually, once you are aware that like the sort of, you know, lived experience, the life world of a lesbian in 2024 is very different than what it is in 1989 or 1999, then I think the sort of salience of these movies becomes much more apparent. But, and, you know, like, usually the story is told of, you know, like, of progress, right? Like, you know, there's the bad old days when there was repression, and now we're much more accepting. And there's a bunch of reasons to doubt that narrative, one of which is a kind of, you know, the backlash against gender nonconformity has not gone away by any means. But the other is that these shifts in material condition that might make an earlier lesbian life experience somehow like either attractive or give it a new salience or value to people who are living in 2024. And I think that that helps explain like the two movies that we're going to be discussing.
Absolutely.
So yeah, Driveway Dolls is set in this earlier period where lesbian bars thrived a bit more. And maybe to like sort of situate the movie a little bit in terms of being a throwback, I believe it's been reported that the script was actually written in the early part of this century, like around 2001, 2002. So the script was actually written a few years after the movie set. The movie set in 1999. And it was written by Ethan Coen and his wife, Trisha Cook, who interestingly identifies as queer. And they put the script aside for a variety of reasons. And then more recently, as the longtime partners, Joel Coen and Ethan Coen, the team of brothers, have taken a break from each other, Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook decided to revive the script. So it is really a script from an earlier period, but I think making that this movie now, making it in or releasing it in 2024, you do suddenly get these issues of sort of nostalgia. And I think almost purely by happenstance, it has become a kind of movie of nostalgic remembrance of, you know, really
now seems like the golden age of lesbian bars. That the, you know, the road trip movie, and you know, I should say it's a very kind of silly movie, goofy sort of send off of the buddy comedy and the road trip movie and the thriller movie. But I think what emotional heart is in the movie is in that kind of nostalgia for that period of lesbian history. I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, it's a very different depiction of lesbian life than would be recognizable to somebody like of my generation. You know, it is a period of lesbian life in which there is a bar in every like small city across the American, you know, Southeast. That was very strange. It is a depiction of lesbian life that is sort of, you know, it has this 90s feminist political earnestness. Like one of the jokes is about the sort of straight man and this like straight man silly man comedy duo, and the straight man like used to work for a woman who or used to date a woman who worked for Ralph Nader, you know. It's like jokes like that, right? It's got this they occupy a very specific political world in which, you know, there is earnestness but there is not as acute a threat of violence from the homophobic right. The other thing is that they are driving through the American South with sort of like minimal fear of violence. There is a bit of nostalgia for, I think, the otherness itself, right? This is a sort of pre-integration account of lesbian life, in which the spaces are separate. They're sort of not subjected to as much influence or, I guess, like incursion by straight culture, right? So it's this little crucibles of lesbian life that are dotted around the country that are like sort of evolving on their own, which is a very different experience from being a mid-20s dyke now or back, you know, redacted years ago when I was doing that, in which, you know, the boundaries between what was a lesbian space and what was a straight or mainstream space were a lot more porous, in which the internet was much more heavily involved, and in which, you know, the negotiation of homophobia had a very, very different politics, right? This is sort of, it's a nostalgia for like just an infrastructure of lesbian spaces, right? There are these businesses and bars that are sustainable throughout vast swaths of the country in a way that, as we discussed, is not really possible now. But also there was, it's a nostalgia for a different political posture by lesbians towards the straight world and by the straight world towards lesbians.
Yeah, no. The point about the not being as threatened is a very interesting one, because it's almost a kind of suggestion that the more hard reactionary turn is just starting in the movie, that you have this political figure who's a senator who is a sort of comically funny, but is maybe like a precursor or an early larval stage of the sort of Ron DeSantis politics. But precisely because it's a kind of earlier manifestation, he does not seem like as threatening as the real world example is today. But I mean, I should mention just in terms of you know, the story. Yeah, there's these two main characters, Jamie played by Margaret Qualley and Marion played by Geraldine Viswanathan, and they are like you know, the classic opposites that end up being attracted to each other, you know, a romantic comedy norm, one of whom is very straight-laced, very earnest, a reader of Henry James. And I think in the title card of the movie, the movie's title is not Drive Away Dolls. It's Henry James's Drive Away Dolls. And the other Character Jamie is you know, very much the opposite, very loose, freewheeling, sexually very open. So in a lot of ways, the movie is kind of a romantic comedy of how these two friends become more than friends. And it's interestingly mirrored by the, I think, the same sort of straight-laced and repressed versus the more open is mirrored in the villains of the piece, who are the killers who are chasing them, who also have that same dichotomy, but they don't get their happy ending. And I won't spoil anything more. So how do you think it works as a nostalgia film? Like, do you think that it has charm, or is it like, you know, is it kind of ancien regime, longing for like a simpler time?
Can I say yes to both? You know, I think it has.
Yeah.
It's a very charming movie. It's funny. It's light. It is a like kind of perfectly distilled, like buddy road trip movie, right? It is doing something that I see a lot of Hollywood movies doing, which is using a lesbian plot, this sort of like new innovation of the lesbian plot, or the new narrative tool of the lesbian plot, to inject a kind of new life into a much older genre that might have previously gone stagnant, you know? So you see this, you see this a lot with period dramas, with things like, you know, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Ammonite, The Favorite, right? These are sort of old school kind of dramas that have a tense psychological element that might be, you know, an examination of a certain period in history, that might be dealing with, you know, social satire in ways that we might feel like we kind of know, but that are sort of lent this new perspective by the injection of sort of a lesbian character, right? I think they are good. I think both the movies that we're talking about today, both Drive Away Dolls and Love Lies Bleeding, are sort of innovations, I think, for my part, welcome innovations in the lesbian film, in that the fact that these characters are lesbians is not the driving force of the plot. These are not coming out stories. These are not really, except, you know, as sort of an additional creator of tension, stories about homophobia. These are primarily stories about the characters themselves, right? So I found that the nostalgia for an older kind of lesbian life in Drive Away Dolls just sort of like mirrored what I feel is like maybe the film's more essential project, which is nostalgia for a different kind of, like an older kind of movie, right? In which these comedic plots can be goofy, they can be light, they can have sort of improbable flights of plot. A nice thing about it being a period piece from the late 1990s is that it is not burdened by the presence of the internet, either narratively or in terms of its creation or depiction of lesbian life, right? Like, it's also got some nice plot holes that are enabled, or plot progressions that are enabled by the fact that nobody has a fucking cell phone. I found its project to be really about reviving this buddy comedy genre with a sort of like light Coen Brothers style absurdism of its humor. And then I found the lesbian nostalgia to be this sort of additional marketing ploy that like put its narrative project to sort of more modern uses, right? This is something that I could probably talk about all day, but in a lot of these online lesbian cultures that have sort of now replaced the gay bar for people a little bit younger than me, you actually do see a lot of nostalgia for lesbian cultures that predated those women's lives and birth, right? There's a lot of sort of rediscoveries of, you know, old archival material, of old, you know, second wave and later lesbian histories, of periodicals like, you know, On Our Backs. There is in, not in Drive Away Dolls, but in Love Lives Bleeding, which also sort of partakes a little bit, to a lesser extent, of this, like, older lesbian life nostalgia. The Kristen Stewart character is reading a book called Macho Sluts, which is this sort of cult classic bit of lesbian smut from, like, the late 70s and early 80s. It's like a... The book is almost like a meme, right? It has been rediscovered and taken up by these much younger women who found it on the internet, even though it is very much a relic of this 1970s past, right? So there's this overlapping of, like, millennial and Gen Z nostalgia for these physical spaces, for this older culture, for this sort of, like, bygone lesbian era that is also being nodded to when a movie like Drive Away Dolls gets made and released in 2024.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's probably a good time to take up Love Lies Bleeding, because it has many of these same elements, but it told in a different tone, or maybe in a variety of different tones. It's not the sort of, like, light comedy of Drive Away Dolls. And I think there, the sort of romantic comedy element and the sexual element, which is in Drive Away Dolls, becomes much more at the forefront, and maybe brings up maybe the other reason for the lesbian plot that's maybe worth thinking about, which is not just that it's a way of injecting new life into older narratives, but also lesbian eros is maybe a way of trying to depict a less fraught and problematic eros than heterosexual relations, that, like, in some ways, like, you know, like so much of heterosexuality seems so problematic that if you want to deal with these stories, perhaps the lesbian narrative allows you to have characters that have sexual drives, but, you know, one doesn't have to ask the questions that one should ask if one of these characters were male. Do you think that makes any sense? Or, like, I feel like there's a way in which these movies, like, kind of maybe use the lesbian plot as a way of making the erotic more central. Because I think one of the big complaints about 20th century movies, Hollywood movies, is everyone is always saying that, well, there's no sex in these movies, you know, and maybe this is a way of bringing sex back into the movies. And I certainly think, like, with Love Lies Bleeding, the sex is a much bigger part of the movie than in Drive Away Dolls.
Yeah, I mean, Love Lies Bleeding is a confusing, weird, ambitious, and ultimately very unsuccessful movie that is carried almost entirely by how hot Katie O'Brien is, who is a an action star.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
She's, like, an action star. She's a bodybuilder. She's been in, like, some Marvel stuff, speaking of sexless movies.
Yeah. Before. Yeah, well, it is also a superhero movie. Love Lies Bleeding is both a thriller and it has elements of the Incredible Hulk.
And it's also in some ways, you know, like, almost a DARE educational anti-drug video about the dangers of steroids. But it's a strange movie, right? But you can sort of see buried in Love Lives Bleeding's, like, sort of excess of plots. You can see what I think would have been a very straightforward post-Me Too revenge movie in which two women who are sort of socially marginal outsiders take revenge on an abusive man. And that, I think, should have been what Love Lies Bleeding was. And that would have fit, you know, that's one of, like, 1800 things that Love Lies Bleeding tries to do. including some, as you mentioned, some like quasi supernatural stuff. It gets like, it's fun. Like, this is not this is not a good film, but I had so much fun watching it because it was bad in so many like kind of over the top delightful ways. But
I should mention just to do the normal film criticism stuff. He's directed by Rose Glass, who's an up and coming filmmaker, and as you mentioned, Katie O'Brien is in there as well as Kristen Stewart, and they are the kind of couple. But yeah, it is exactly a one best of a movie. I don't know if you want to, I think you've already outlined some of the elements of it, but maybe just give the quick summary of the brief, what plot there is. And then we could talk about the fact, which I also agree with, that it's fun. The audience I was with who saw the movie, everyone was enjoying it a lot, laughing a lot. And I think it is perhaps a camp classic. Go back and say the.
Yeah, Kristen Stewart is working at a gym in nowhere, I think Arizona, you know, somewhere in the Southwest. And, you know, of all the juke joints in all the world, in drifts Katie O'Brien, who is a bodybuilder and a drifter with a mysterious past, who is hanging out locally, working at a gun range and spending a lot of time in Kristen Stewart's gym trying to get ready for this bodybuilding show she's going to compete in Vegas. And they get together and we discover that Kristen Stewart's sister is being pretty brutally abused by her husband. And Kristen Stewart starts giving Katie O'Brien steroids that she has access to through some unsavory characters in her own life. And the combination of these factors lead our heroines on a extended journey into a life of violence and crime and into the dark underworld that has been, you know, secretly controlling this Arizona town. Supernatural elements, there are comedic elements, there are like mob movie elements. And I think you would call it like, if Driveaway Dolls is a revival of the buddy road trip movie, Love Lives Bleeding attempts to revive really the erotic thriller, right? Which I will say is like at, like kind of refreshingly believable. Something about this, the lesbian movie as a genre, the like lesbian plot that I would say has emerged really since 2015 and Todd Haynes's Carol, is that it's often the couple is cast with like two straight actresses who each look like they'd rather be kissing, you know, a paper bag. There's no chemistry at all. I had that, a little bit of that problem with Driveaway Dolls. I have that problem with Carol. That's really not a problem in Love Lives Beating. They are like two very hot people who are just kind of like smoldering at each other for like the 90 minutes of the film. But it's a confused little film. But I like what you bring up about the sort of problems that heterosexuality poses for Hollywood now, right? Because I date the rise of the lesbian plot in Hollywood movies, as I just said, like really to Carol. Like Carol was a big success. It came out, I believe, in 2015, which is the same year as Obergefell, right? So it sort of just hit movement of the mass, like 180 turnaround of gay acceptance that had happened right there at that historical moment. And it sort of solved this problem of how Hollywood could engage this new market of gay moviegoers who were sort of newly empowered and who are growing. There's just more gay people than there used to be. You know, Ben Shapiro has his set of theories about that. I have mine. I'll spare you. But there, it's a fact. There are more LGBT people than there used to be. And also, the lesbian plot allowed Hollywood to do this without sacrificing male moviegoers, right? Because the gay male plot is much more threatening to male moviegoers. It excludes a lot more people. This is part of just the difference between homophobia as it is directed at gay men and gay women, right? Gay women are seen as much less sexually threatening, much less sort of menacing to men's identities, much less like imperiling towards straight women. You know, there's a lot more people for a variety of, I think, not very admirable cultural reasons who will go see lesbians and then who will go see a plot about two gay men in love, right? So you can also see this, like the counterfactual is the attempt a couple years back to make a gay male rom-com called Bros that just failed spectacularly. It was like this absolute like catastrophe at the box office. Then you see like some smaller, less ambitious projects like All of Us Strangers is a movie that came out in which Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal play a gay male couple. But that plot is sort of subordinated to this like grief plot. You know, it was a sad like kind of art housey movie that was never going to make a lot of money and didn't. But like the bigger movies, the ones that are seeking to bring in bigger audiences, might have bigger budgets, those tend to be lesbian plots in the world of gay movies that we're talking about, right? This is something new. Hollywood was really not taking up the lesbian plot, you know, so you would see it. You see, like, lesbian films sort of being made in sort of the world of Driveaway Dolls. There were, like, there was an explosion of, like, lesbian films in the early 90s, right? So, like, this really sweet kind of, like, coming-of-age rom-com, like, the incredible two-story of two girls in love. There was Cheryl Dunya's, I think, like, actual masterpiece of sort of meta film criticism called The Watermelon Woman has a really wonderful lesbian plot. And then like super low budget indie films like Go Fish, you know, like there was that, but that wasn't Hollywood. Hollywood really embraced the lesbian plot after 2015. And I think a big part of it is the increase in acceptance, right? This is a novel narrative territory. But then I think I think the lesbian plot took on new valence after Me Too.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think that is a big juncture point.
Right, because Me Too made the violence structures a lot of heterosexuality that might sort of inform heterosexuality's logic. That might complicate viewers' understandings of a heterosexual plot. All that became very, very urgent, right? It became something not that it was at the sort of fringes of culture that you might hear at an academic conference. It was something that people were talking about and thinking about even as they went to see their, you know, popcorn-crunching blockbuster movies, right? So if you want to deal with the erotic, it helps, frankly, to just ventriloquize your male characters as women. And some of these, I feel, you know, or I suspect, were written as heterosexual plots and then had a woman just sort of swapped into the male character's place, right? I feel that way, or that's like one reading I have of the movie Tar, which is a lesbian plot about something that in our real lived world almost always happens to men, which is, large scale public cancellation over, a Me Too style sexual harassment campaign revelation, right? That is something.
Yeah, I don't think that there's ever been like anyone in the world of classical music that's been a woman that has been canceled in the way of Tar, but there actually have been many men who have had that experience. But there is a way in which, by making her a woman, you can create more ambiguity or complexity than would be there like if it was a man. I think that that's a very telling point about that script.
Right, and that's a story where, if a man is in that role, in that position of that Lydia Tarr is in, we know everything about him, right? And his interiority ceases to be interesting. It's like, okay, well, I know about his tortured narcissism. I know about his sort of, swaggering entitlement. I know about his psychological cruelty because I know like 100 of that fuck it guy, If it's a woman, that sort of changes that person's social conditioning. It changes the way that person is received, and it allows the movie to go into a little more depth, right? I think it would have been a much less successful movie. My pet theory about Tar is if it's very beautiful, very successful, very intelligent, and ultimately politically reactionary as a film.
I absolutely agree.
Then you also see sort of similar attempts being made to like recolor, history, right? So like The Favorite was a very successful art house movie, nominally about the reign of Queen Anne, but really about sort of the psychological mechanisms of infertility and about what happens in among the powerful in the face of a weak leader, right? I think the most successful, or at least like the strongest lesbian plot film of this new lesbian plot era was Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is sort of like an allegory about art making and the relationship between the artist and the muse, that sort of uses gender dynamics without becoming like totally consumed by them, right? But these are, there was that weird... speaking of Kristen Stewart, there was that weird Princess Diana biopic that she was in.
Oh, yes. It
also had a completely unnecessary and unfeasible lesbian plot out of nowhere. Because it was trying to remind viewers or make possible for viewers that this person in an incredibly repressed environment might also have like a degree in a erotic life. But I think your point is taken, right? That... in some ways, the lesbian plot has been used to help Hollywood avoid looking at heterosexuality and to revive these genres that would now not work in a post-Me Too sexual politics, but allow them to make the erotic or the sexual kind of fun and appealing again without its burden of this awareness of straight violence. And for me... actually, the best example of this is Bottoms. Did you see Bottoms?
No, I haven't seen Bottoms, though.
Oh, it's actually, like, really fun. Like Drive Away Dolls, it is this, like, kind of time capsule. It's not set in a different era, but it feels like a movie from a different era. like Love, Lives, Bleeding, it kind of mishes a bunch of, like, kind of bizarre elements together in a ways that's not always successful. But it is a revival of this sort of forgotten comedy genre, which in Drive Away Dolls is the road trip buddy movie, and in Bottoms is the teen sex comedy.
American Pie. I know the genre very well. And that makes total sense. And I think it's in keeping with the sort of theses that we're developing, which is, you can revive these genres and make them a little bit less problematic and palatable, make them more palatable by putting in lesbians. I will actually go watch Bottoms now. I think that's...
it's silly. I don't know how old your kids are. It might not be a. They might not want to watch it with their dad. But
no, I don't. I don't think. Yeah. They're not quite ready for that. Yeah.
It's got silliness. It's got violence. It's got like a very. I think it was made in 2022. Like a very 2022 sexual politics. It has a little bit of a Me Too plot, or like a threat of a Me Too plot, but then it just devolves into this way for sexuality to be serious, like unserious, like fantastically giggly, stupid, unserious. Erotic drives. There's a really good joke in Bottoms where these two teenage girls are trying to figure out why they're unpopular, and they're like, it's probably because we're lesbians, right? And then they're like, or it's because we're unpleasant and we act weird. And as somebody who is trying to blame my own unpopularity on homophobia in the past, I felt very seen. It's like But yeah, it's a way to revive this and to make sort of a shortcut around the genre's actual politics by sort of just putting in women where men would be. As a feminist, I sort of want to say to heterosexuality, like, leave us out of it. Like, deal with your own problems. Yeah. Don't, like, use us to ventriloquize your men and their, you know, bad habits. But as a movie watcher, I think some of these are kind of successful. I think, you know, some of these are, they have their moments of not just levity, but like genuine humor, and not just sort of, you know, sterily depicted beautiful bodies, but like actual erotic charge. And it's nice. It's nice. It's a nice way to spend an evening.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I enjoyed both the movies we talked about this week, and like you, perhaps I enjoyed Drive Away Dolls a bit more. But although, I mean, they're both like really fun, and I think sort of silly fun should not be underrated. And I think in terms of the question of the audience, my sense, both from going to see the movies and also reading the reviews, is although they're appealing to a broad audience that includes many different types of people, they are actually finding a lesbian audience. And it seems like in both movies, the reviews I read have certainly indicated the lesbian viewers are picking up on stuff that maybe the broader audience isn't. So I think so. So in that sense, I'm willing to exonerate these movies from, you know, the charge of being purely exploitive or, you know, like exoticizing for the sake of selling tickets. Like it does seem like they are. They have a kind of like a broad appeal without marginalizing the people who are actually like the subjects of the movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a blast. My wife and I we laughed very hard. it was a good time.
Yeah, okay, good. So anyways, thank you. I think this has been a really great discussion. And I think you brought up more about these movies than has been widely discussed, certainly in, like, you know, I read a lot of the reviews. So I'm actually glad that, you know, like, this discussion of the lesbian plot actually, like, I think situates these movies very well. So once again, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Pete. I had a blast.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video, find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.